we've already studied a sensationalist approach to knowledge. Knowledge is based on sensations, from a man who claimed to be a strict materialist. Well, here in France, we have something like a Hobbesian school of thought, although not all were materialists. The first we'll mention, Étienne Condillac, C-O-N-D-I-L-L-A-C, 1715 to 1780. Condillac is right there on the board. C-O-N-D-I-L-L-A-C. And he wrote a treatise on sensations. You understand why they're called sensationalist? Please don't think that that means, well, these were people who always were making a sensation out of everything. You know, they're like exaggerating and, you know, sensationalist. No, they're sensationalist. Well, hey, people make that mistake. Don't laugh at me. Sensationalist because they thought knowledge is based on sensation. The book was published in 1754, Treatise on Sensations. He said, all consciousness is really transformed sensations. Even what we call reflection, inner reflection, is but a form of perception. The mind is, in fact, completely passive. Everything that takes place in the mind is a version of sensation then. Well, I know the Enlightenment thinkers thought they were pretty smart and so forth, and they had a lot of confidence and reason and all that. But again, you've done enough philosophy, even as first-year students, to see through this. If the mind is totally passive, and all that takes place, even our reflections, are just forms of perception, I mean, how are you going to explain that? How can you explain self-consciousness? How can you explain the bringing together of perceptions and a reflection upon them as nothing more but perceptions themselves? If I were to bring in here today a wheelbarrow full of bricks and spend all day long, you know, bumping them up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, would the bricks ever become conscious of themselves as bricks? Now, I know I'm giving, overstating in a sense by hyperbole an analogy, but you have to understand this is a very naive epistemology. A passive mind which only has perceptions is never going to be conscious of itself as a mind receiving perceptions. According to Condillac, there is no knowledge of substance because, of course, we don't perceive substance. You've heard that before. And although he thought reflection is a form of perception, he did say matter cannot think. So he was not a materialist. Yeah, I know, it's hard to put it all together. He doesn't want to be a materialist, but he does want to say that inner reflection is just a fancy form of perception. Let's move on. Claude Helvetius, H-E-L-V-E-T-I-U-S, lived from 1715 to 1771. He held that the mind is a blank tablet. The mind is a blank tablet. Comment? Did Condillac, does Helvetius, do these guys sound like they're presenting really novel views? They aren't. The French sensationalists tended to pick this up from British empiricism. I think you can see that. John Locke, the mind is a blank tablet. According to him, our desires arise from our experiences of pleasure and pain. And therefore, we are led empirically to an egoistic hedonism. That is, the right thing to do is what will advance your own pleasure. And yet Helvetius wanted to maintain that egoistic hedonism had to be kept in line with the moral teaching of the church. Little oil and water here, you know. Next, Julien Lemaître, M-E-T-T-R-I-E. 1709 to 1751, his most well-known work, which really tells you the whole story of his philosophy, published in 1748, Man, a Machine. Man, a Machine. So he's a materialist in his outlook, unlike some of his other these other philosophers we've looked at. According to him, the soul perishes with the body, and the soul is affected by the condition of the body. So whatever man is that makes him more than just a brick, whatever his soul is, it nevertheless passes away with the body. Man is continuous with the animal and plant worlds. There's nothing else going on in man but what you find in animals and plants, even though in man it may be more complex. And he presented in his book what we call a mechanistic psychology. The way in which man's mind, what we call his mind, of course it's just like animal and plant processes, but what we call a mind operates in a mechanical fashion. And Lemaitre promoted an ethics then of maximum sensual enjoyment. Man is only a machine. He's continuous with the animal world. So you ought to live for whatever gives you a lot of pleasure. Sensual enjoyment. Did I see a question? Will?
What were his dates again?
Lemaitre, 1709 to 1751. I don't have in my notes, and I can't remember that they had the same kind of thing as some of the English deists. No, this was more a period of. I take that back now, because we're going to be looking at Condorcet, and he was arrested. But of course, he was arrested. That's not a good example, because he was arrested by the Jacobeans, by the revolutionaries. I'm not aware that they were. Yeah, well, you are right. And, of course, Voltaire is in the same period of time, so I guess we could take him as an example of somebody who suffered social ostracization and political persecution for his views. What I was saying is I just don't know about Condillac, Helvetius, and Lemaitre. Let's move on. Dietrich von Holbach. 1723 to 1789. Dietrich von Holbach. Now you look at your outline. This is the French Enlightenment. And here I give you a Dietrich von Holbach. What's wrong here? Well, he was a German. That's why he has a German name. But he lived in France. Okay? And Holbach, or von Holbach, is best known for his book published in 1770, System of Nature. Von Holbach was a materialist who said that all mental phenomena are to be explicated as the activity of matter. All mental phenomena, all of our experiences, perceptual experiences, must be explicated as the activity of matter. So that the functions of what we call mind are really just the activity of the brain. The functions of what we call mind are really just the activity of the brain. Well, how are there then mental functions or something that seems like a soul within man? According to von Holbach, the soul is epiphenomenal. Epiphenomenal. Let's see if we can understand this just by breaking the word down. I've already defined for you a phenomena, right? Phenomena is an experience. in the natural world, a perceptual experience, the way things come to me and I, in my mind, how they appear to me. An epiphenomenal means that which arises and goes above the phenomena. Epiphenomenalism, a nice analogy, is the babbling of the brook. Okay? Sometimes you've been in the mountains near a flowing stream or a brook, and you hear the water babbling, as we say. Okay? The babbling is not water, is it? But it's an epiphenomena. It's something that arises from the activity of the water. And likewise, von Holbach believed that our souls, what we call souls, or mental functions, arise from our body functions. That isn't to say that they're body, but it's to say that the appearances, what arises out of the appearances we have from bodies, is mental. He held that all human behavior is mechanical and deterministic, that men should be guided by the principles of nature, not by God, not by the church, not by custom, not even by the institutions of civilization. Back to nature. But then this is a funny thing to say, isn't it? Man should be guided by nature. If he's already said that nature determines human behavior, one might say, if nature determines human behavior, I don't have to get back to nature. I'm just doing what nature makes me do. And von Holbach, like Lemaître, maintained that there's a fundamental continuity between man and animals. Man is nothing more but a more complex or advanced animal. Okay, enough about the sensationalist and the materialist in the French Enlightenment. I want to talk about one other French Enlightenment thinker and the most important of all, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. R-O-U-S-S-E-A-U. I hope all of you have heard of him. You've done some reading about him. Jean-Jacques was born in Geneva, Calvin's town. He lived from 1712 to 1778. 1778. Sound familiar? It's also the year Voltaire died, 2 years after Hume died and we signed the Declaration of Independence. Born in Geneva, but from 1741 on, he lived mainly in Paris. Rousseau was befriended by Hume, David Hume, but he later quarreled with Hume. In fact, this is a sad commentary that you'll know something about next term when I have you read the book Intellectuals by Paul Johnson. Rousseau quarreled with everyone. He couldn't get along with anybody. He was a self-centered, well, you fill in the blank. He also was befriended by George III. I think that's relevant for those of us living in America because hopefully you remember your history. It's King George III that we declared our independence from and brought covenantal lawsuit against in the Declaration of Independence. Rousseau gained fame in 1749 by writing a prize essay for the Academy of Dijon. Every time you eat that kind of mustard, I want you to remember Rousseau, the Academy of Dijon, 1749, prize essay. The reason why Rousseau is important is not just his influence, but he represents a real turn of direction in Enlightenment thinking. Everybody we've been looking at up to this point has emphasized reason and nature. Nature is orderly. It is controlled in a law-like way. It may be materialistic even. and reason is the center of man's activity and his dignity and so forth. Rousseau was not a rationalist. He was a romantic. Rousseau is the fountainhead of romanticism, which puts emphasis not on reason, but on feeling, on sentiment, and therefore is a much more subjectivistic approach to philosophy and life than is the Enlightenment or deism. We've been looking at major dichotomies throughout the history of thought in this course, you know, faith and reason, fact and value, and so forth. For Rousseau, the dialectic or the dichotomy that he saw was between nature and freedom. You have the nature, the natural world, I don't have room on the board to put this, but you have the natural world down here, and then man's freedom is something that's not part of the natural world. And the emphasis must rest upon man as a subjective, if you will, sentimental, free being. A little bit about his philosophy. Rousseau wrote contrary to Voltaire, advocating the equal rights of all men in a democracy. Remember I told you Voltaire's view of civil rights was under a beneficent king. Rousseau disagreed with that and advocated democracy, the equal rights of all. According to Rousseau, what I'm going to tell you now is so important for the history of thought, I don't know what to do. I wish I had neon lights, you know, that were going off here. Rousseau says man is naturally good. He is born innocent. He is born free. He's born equal with all other men. And his life should be guided by the instincts of his heart. Man is born innocent, free, equal with all others, and his life should be guided by the instincts of his heart. Well, of course, Rousseau stands over against Thomas Hobbes then, doesn't he? Hobbes says that the original nature of man is one of warfare and ambition and running afoul of one another and violence and so forth. Men are not good. They aren't reasonable. Rousseau says, oh no, men are naturally good. They're born innocent, free, equal, and they should be guided by the instincts of their heart. But you know, even more important, he stands not just over against Hobbes, but for a man who was born in Geneva, who's he stand over against? John Calvin. And of course, I believe, to be prejudicial here for a minute, John Calvin represents the teaching of the Bible. Does the Bible say, hey, men are naturally really good? this gets to be pretty incredible. It's a romantic version of human nature. And what I like to do, I mean, this is not philosophically sound, but if you'd like to do a little trial and error thing, I'd suggest you put a couple of two-year-olds in the same room with one toy. And then draw your conclusions about how men are born so good and equal and so forth. You'd expect the two-year-olds in their goodness to say, well, you use the toy for a while, then I'll use the toy for a while, right? But instead, what I've found is you get things like, mine! Men are born in the state of nature good, though. Well, how did these children get so corrupt? What happened? According to Rousseau, evil is due to the corrupting influence of civilization. Evil is due to the corrupting influence of civilization. And that's why he uses this expression, which is fairly famous for his philosophy. He said, men are born free, but everywhere are in chains. Men are born free. You remember that movie from long ago? Born free, as the wind blows. I know that's really schmaltzy and all, but that's what Rousseau believed. People are born free, just like that lion. But everywhere they are now in chains, the chains of civilization that have corrupted them, made them selfish. Secondly, this idea gives rise to the whole myth of the noble savage. The noble savage. And I'd like to tell you that, of course, everybody's gotten beyond that kind of lunacy to believe that, you know, if you take the uncivilized peoples of the world, savages in their natural state, that they prove to be noble people. My goodness. One has got to wonder about the alleged objectivity of that kind of claim. What you find when you study the uncivilized tribes of the world is cannibalism, a failure to respect private property, violence, warfare, superstition, on and on and on. But not for Rousseau. For Rousseau, one of the greatest things you could do is go to a South Sea island, get away from the corrupting influence of civilization, and live among the natives in their natural purity. Do we see that kind of rhetoric in our day and age? Yes, the natural world is so good and so forth. I mean, I just saw this week while I was in town going through the TV channels some program on, you know, to find the lost tribe and the idea that this lost tribe, you see, had learned to live together with peace. Everybody has what they need. You know, there's no warfare. There's no disease and so forth. Where do diseases come from? Where does competition, warfare, private property, and all those sorts of things come from? Why do we have those problems? Well, Rousseau says, because the noble savage has been corrupted by civilization. Well, the fact is, man is in chains now. He is in civilized orders. How can man be saved? How can the problems of men be alleviated? And Rousseau's answer was through education. In 1762, he published his book, Emile, which was a proposal for completely revising the education of children. Education should develop the individual's natural impulses, natural feelings, and natural sentiments. Okay, are we getting a certain picture of life here? Men are naturally good, the noble savage. They're born innocent. But then civilization comes in and corrupts them. One might wonder, how did the first noble savage ever start down the line of evil and civilization and corruption? But we'll let that go. And then we will counteract the savage consequences of civilization by what? Developing man's mind. Salvation through education. Rousseau is the father of the zeitgeist of America, at least secular America. Think about this. I mean, these are typically American, the outworkings are typically American in their cultural expression. We need good public schools if we're going to civilize people. And, of course, civilization can have such a corrupting, degrading influence. We really need to protect wildlife and the environment and so forth. I mean, these things don't really hang together philosophically very well, but nevertheless, it's typically the spirit of our age in America. And even more so, if we went back 100 years and everything, the idea that schools will make us good citizens, we'll get along, nature is good, man is basically all right. You know that, don't you? Prostitutes have hearts of gold. Just go to the movies. Read the novels. They're really much more sincere and honest people than theologians and pastors and so forth. Am I ringing any bells? Does this sound like one of maybe 100 different movies or novels or short stories that you've heard of? Whether it's a prostitute or whatever. The person who's the down and out in society, who's really closer to nature, is really a much nicer person than those people who have been corrupted by the institutions, the capitalistic institutions, or the religious institutions of man. Yeah, did somebody say Phil Donahue? Yeah, exactly. It's Jean-Jacques Rousseau come back to life. Well, now, one of the real sad things about the fact that the history of thought and culture can't be nicely divided up into this chunk and then another chunk and all that. I've been stressing how all these different lines of thought and individuals interact and so forth, is that I can't really assign to you until next term a book which has a chapter on Rousseau that I wish you had read by now. The book is Paul Johnson's Intellectuals, and we'll look at that next term, because most of the men in the book will be really from the 19th and 20th centuries. But what Johnson does here is he goes and he looks at Rousseau's own life to see how he lives up to his own philosophy, and whether you think you have a noble savage here, a man who whose life is a sterling example of what education can create. Well, I hope you can tell just by the way I'm presenting it. He shreds the guy, and he deserves to be shredded, because this is a bunch of religious hypocrisy. It is a bunch of unbelieving suppression of the truth that God tells us about man and what man really needs. Man is not naturally good. He was at creation good, but he's not now naturally good. He's very selfish, very wicked. He suppresses the truth and unrighteousness. He doesn't live by the law of God. He rationalizes that. He fights with his fellow men. He's violent. He's selfish and greedy. He's not naturally good. And you know what? Men who are not naturally good are not helped by the education process. I've done a lot of the education process. I don't claim to have done as much as some others, but I've done a lot. I have, you know, my high school diploma, and I went to college and a couple of master's degrees and a PhD, and I'm a writer and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I claim a little bit of knowledge of that, and I dare say that education has never ennobled anybody. Education has simply deepened what is already in the character of the person. If you take a good person and educate them, education will help them be good. If you take a wicked person and educate them, you know what? They'll just be more and more wicked. We have this myth that if we could just educate people, they'd stop doing bad things. And that's why in the public schools we have this, you know, campaign to teach people about drugs. Just say no, right? What a typically mythical Rousseau approach to things. Just say no. Or teach them, what do we have, sex education classes, right? Well, you take wicked, selfish, lustful individuals, yes, kids in junior high have just been described, and teach them about sex, and you know what they do with the information? They say, oh, we really should relate to each other in a noble and respectful fashion, show self-control. What an that's lunacy. You know it is. You teach junior high kids about sex, and you're simply going to advance their sexual perversity. Teach them about drugs and how, you know, hurtful drugs can be. What do you think? Have our campaign, our educational campaigns against drugs, really stopped the drug trade? And you know, there are people who will tell you, I know this is not good for me, and then go and do it anyway. That's what we call in theological circles the forbidden fruit syndrome. You see, knowing that something is wicked, knowing that something is bad for you, does not, given a Christian view of human nature, keep you from doing it. There are plenty of people who believe with all their hearts that they will die, and yet they never get around to making a will. Is that a rational failure, or is that a failure of character? Stop and think about these things. Rousseau, well, I mean, I'm getting a little out of hand here. Calm down, Dr. Rousseau was a lunatic. Men are naturally good, and education will save them from the corrupting influences of civilization. Give me a break. I mean, enough fairy tales. Well, I guess it bothers me so much because I've seen the devastation that that point of view has brought to the lives and to the societies that have been influenced by Rousseau's thinking. Real quickly, Rousseau wrote a famous book in 1762 entitled The Social Contract. The Social Contract. According to him, sovereignty in a nation rests solely with the people. Remember, he's democratic over against the monarchical views of Voltaire. Sovereignty rests solely with the people. They have a right of self-determination. And there are inalienable rights that people have, the rights to freedom and equality. The rights to freedom and equality. But now there's a real critical irony about Rousseau's democratic views and the inalienable right to freedom. Because Rousseau says in a democratic order, sometimes men must be forced to be free. Yes, write that down. That's a famous line from Rousseau. He believed that men must be forced to be free. That is, compulsion is used against the minority or against the individual in order that the minority group or the individual can realize his true freedom. That sounds like a little twisting of things, like you begin with democratic inalienable right to freedom, and it turns out that the majority has the right to force you against your will. The reason for this is that Rousseau believed that there was operating in a democratic society, one that is operating properly anyway, a general will. And he labored to distinguish what he called the general will from the will of all, the will of all. And what I just presented to you is the majority kind of lording it over the minority. The view of the majority that you have in that, he says, is that the majority represents the will of all, the collection of selfish ideas and desires. The will of all is just the collection of all the selfishness of the individuals in the group. And Rousseau said that is not the foundation of democracy.